to introduce to you Professor Ulla Paryvin of University of Wisconsin in Madison, United States. Anyone who is concerned with chemical engineering will meet the name of Professor Ulla Paryvin, and not in one place, but in several places. He has done very important work, for example, in the field of mass transfer and in many other fields in chemical engineering. What we are particularly concerned with today is his work in reaction engineering, in applied reaction kinetics, and perhaps even more specifically within the field of heterogeneous catalysis. In this field, Professor Paryvin has made a great contribution, particularly in the way of devising methods by means of which it is possible to describe mathematically the results of experiments. In this way, the experiments can be condensed into a formula which can be used for calculating the reaction equipment, chemical reactors. If one could say something that's characteristic of all the work that Professor Paryvin has done, I think it must be this, that he is always anxious to apply the fundamental sciences to engineering. That is a difficult work, particularly because the applications which one wants to make, they are always rather complicated. Engineering is concerned with real life, and real life is something very different from the abstractions with which pure science works. And still, to be able to use pure science as results in the field of engineering is of essential importance to the development of not only chemical engineering, but all other forms of engineering. I think we have reason to be very grateful to Professor Paryvin for the work he has done in this way, work that's still being continued and from which we expect great results also in the future. I will now call upon Professor Paryvin to give this lecture.
Terry Assen and fellow students, it was my privilege to teach at this institution for one semester 10 years ago. The Jubilee Committee apparently had forgotten that I had already received the highest honor of the institution when I was made a member of Den Retortus Guildnes Selskap. That took place at the Studenter Hitte på Gråkullen. And they gave me a plaque which read something like this: Likesom Olav Tryggvason uppdaget Vinland i året 1000, så Olav Fjellhaugen uppdaget Trondheim i året 1951. Well, 10 years ago, this was a relatively small institution compared to the United Nations that you have now, and there was a high fence all around it. So one of the first days of the Easter vacation, which I knew nothing about, I was working in my office, and at night I found that the campus was empty, vacant, and the buildings were all vacant. There was no caretaker around, and the gates were all locked, and I had no key to the gate, and I had to climb over the fence to get out. And I did that for several days, and then my wife and I went down to the Astoria Hotel to eat during Easter week. And we found we were the only ones there. And we discovered that everyone was out in the mountains. So I went out to Leon to learn to ski. And I looked over that perilous mountain slope, and I remarked to the ski master that this is extremely difficult and perilous. And then he looked at me rather in disgust, and he said, Leon, bare for small barn. So, So I went up to Graukollen. And there I saw young men committing suicide by jumping off that high mountaintop. So I went up to the ski master and asked him if he would teach me how to ski. And he looked at me and he saw my low shoes and this big heavy overcoat. And he said in words of disgust, "Alldeles umulig." De må ha støvler, strømper og genser. Dessuten blir det bare 6 måneder til av sne. Well, today I'm going to not speak of any particular field of research, but sort of give you a bird's eye view of the scientific and engineering aspects of solid catalysts. And I'm doing this because I think it is a remarkable field for research. It is right in the fringe of science and industry, and it represents the greatest field of industrial development in which our knowledge is very, very meager. There's hundreds of years work left in this field, even under these highly accelerated conditions of technical advancement. There's been a tremendous amount of work done on the solid state physics. However, most of it is of interest to the electrical engineer in the design, development of transistors. Very little pertains to catalytic activity. I want to present on the board an outline of the field of solid catalysts and try to indicate by a number of slides the development up to date in these fields and show you the vacancies that are needed for development in order to put this on a scientific basis. Reactor design or reactor control involving reactions that are catalyzed by solids is quite meaningless unless one knows a great deal about the properties of the catalyst itself. In fact, the rate equations that are published on reaction rates involving solid catalysts are worthless as far as design is concerned, unless you're dealing with the identical catalyst, and that means with respect to all its properties. Raw materials, its method of manufacture, every detail has to be prescribed. It's the field in which the greatest obscurity exists at the present time. So we're going to give you or present here the scientific aspect and the engineering aspect of solid catalysts. Most of the research has been done on just very small portions of these aspects. And yet, as far as the engineer is concerned, he must be familiar with all the various aspects of catalysts. And under the scientific aspects, we have those that deal with the microstructure have those that deal with the macrostructure. And under the microstructure, we have the adsorption on the surface of the catalyst. The most essential step in catalytic action. Then we have the aspects that pertain to the crystal and electronic structure. And then we have the aspects dealing with the defect structure. The activity of a catalyst depends upon the fact that it's a non-equilibrium state. Its activity is due to the fact that it's not in equilibrium, it's not true crystal structure. I mean an ideal crystalline structure. Then we have the prediction of activity from molecular structure and bond energies. Now, inasmuch as there cannot, at the present time, there is no development of activity based upon quantum mechanics or statistical mechanics, the very best we can do under the present circumstances is an empirical approach. Now this might well be shifted over to the engineering side, because the procedure does not follow along purely scientific lines. Then we have the matrix structure, which involves the surface area and the pore size and the distribution of the capillaries and the pore space. And on the engineering aspects, we have the carrier to consider. The various promoters that increase the activity of a catalyst. The problems of manufacture. We have mass and heat transfer from the catalyst to the ambient fluid through the surround the catalyst. We have the pressure drop through the bed. In packed beds or in fluidized beds. We have the problem of holdback, which means the residence time distribution. We have the effectiveness factor, which deals with the gradients of temperature and composition through the catalyst pellet itself to the inside of the pellet. Then we have the effective thermal conductivity of the bed. That, of course, is essential to get the gradients longitudinal and radial in the reactor of temperature. Then we have the problem of activity
decline.
And capitalist regeneration. Now, I don't know. As far as I know, this entire consideration does not appear in print. And, of course, we could devote many hours to any one of these particular topics. And therefore, this lecture can be terminated at any time, but I'm only anxious to present to you the tremendous scope. And even though you can't be an authority on any one of these particular aspects of it, why, you should be familiar with the problems involved. The catalytic activity of solids was first noticed by Van Narum in 1796 in the dehydrogenation of alcohols by metals. And then Michael Faraday, discovered the synthesis of ammonia by platinum catalyst. But it wasn't until 90 years later that the Haber process of ammonia synthesis was developed, perhaps the most revolutionary process in the chemical technology, because of its tremendous impact on the production of fertilizers. At the present day, thousands of reactions are catalyzed by, industrial reactions are catalyzed by solids. In the United States alone, most gasoline is produced by a catalytic action in the production of 1 × 10 to the, that many kilograms of gasoline by catalytic action. And the catalysts produced, one-third of the catalysts are produced by one company here. Or for the hydrogenation of ethylene, there are 200,000 tons per year. And of ammonia, there's this many tons per year produced by catalytic activity. Or in the purification of hydrogen, there's 2 × 10^11 cubic feet. That wasn't a very cubic meters. 2 × 10^10 cubic meters. And those are the astonishing figures that you have indicating the extreme importance of catalysts. And yet, as far as the literature is concerned, or as far as universities, technical institutes are concerned, in our education, very little enlightenment is presented on this subject. In the development of the catalyst for the synthesis of ammonia, the Germans tried out 20,000 different catalysts before they selected the one that was satisfactory. Now, that figure alone, 20,000 different catalysts, must impress you with the tremendous lack of guidance by scientific principles. It's a field that must be opened. Well, let's review as much of this as we can, just to indicate the present status of it. In order for a solid catalyst to operate, it adsorption of one or more of the reactants must take place. Catalytic activity is not possible except by adsorption. And it's usually chemisorption, although you can have physical adsorption also. With metals, it's always chemisorption. With nonmetals, you may have both. Chemisorption is preferable because it gives a definite orientation upon adsorption, so that the reaction is more selective. You have a better selectivity. That is, you can restrict the products to a single or to a definite range. Chemisorption always involves a definite orientation so that it's selective, whereas physical adsorption is always random. Now, if you have two reactants, and if they're both adsorbed and compete for the same site, then if your feed is equimolar, it's desirable that the adsorption be equally distributed between the two reactants, so that you find that the laws of Guldberg and Voge also apply to catalytic reactions. If the feed contains an excess of one of the reactants, then it's desirable that there shall be a distribution in the selectivity of adsorption. For the fastest rate, it's desirable that the limiting reactant be preferentially adsorbed. Now, it's desirable that on the surface of this catalyst, adsorption of the reactants, at least one is always necessary, but it's desirable that the product be not adsorbed. Desirable that the product be released without adsorption, because that means that it isn't covering sites, so it allows more room for the reactants to sit down. You'd like to get the seats vacated by the products. And then furthermore, it reduces the reverse reaction. Well, now those are common principles that I've enumerated here, but you seldom see them stated as far as catalytic activities are concerned. If there's only one reactant involved and there's no dissociation, then it's desirable that chemisorption cover the whole surface. If dissociation is involved, then it's desirable that only half of the sites be taken. This adsorption is the most important characteristic, property of a catalyst. Another desirable property is that the energy of activation in adsorption be close to zero as possible. That is, the rate controlling step should not be adsorption. It should be a surface reaction. And usually, if you're selecting an industrial catalyst, you make the selection on that basis, that the energy of activation for adsorption is zero, close to it. It's usually the case. An exception is the synthesis of ammonia. Well, supposing we go on at this point, and maybe in that we can cover the ground most rapidly if we just refer to the slides. I might want to interrupt once in a while. And let's see what is the present state of affairs. Where are we in this field? All right, we'll... models that are generally used for expressing adsorption, both physical and kinetic, or chemi and physical. Every solid is unique in its properties, so that there is no general pattern, but these are the three most generally used patterns. The Langmuir, which says that all the sites have the same activity and that there's no interaction between the adsorbed gases. Well, that's perhaps never realized. So that's an idealized case. As far as total adsorption is concerned, the Langmuir adsorption is very rare indeed. Temkin adsorption means that the molecules that are being adsorbed are immobile. And Freundlich adsorption is the type that you ordinarily get with physical adsorption. And it indicates a high degree of mobility, just like in the condensing condensation of a liquid. You have a high degree of mobility. There's no interaction between the adsorbents. Free to move over the surface. Next slide. These are the equations that might be used to express the surface coverage, the extent of surface coverage in terms of pressure for a gas. The simple Langmuir. The Freundlich, which deals chiefly with physical adsorption, and this Temkin, which applies to immobile adsorption, and it is rather complicated. This Q sub zero is the initial heat of adsorption, because we know that the heat of adsorption decreases with coverage. It remains constant with the Langmuir equation, but in other cases it decreases with coverage, and that's very important. Let's look at what happened. Next slide. Well, this shows how the differential heat of adsorption decreases with the extent of surface coverage, and how the mobility of the adsorbed layer increases with the extent of surface coverage. The next slide. Here we have a case of immobile adsorption by the work of Trapnell for single site and for dual site with dissociation. That falls off, in this case, linearly, as given by the Temkin equation. Now let's get the next slide, and that shows for the single site dissociation. This parameter eta, which is the interaction energy parameter, and it's a unity for immobile adsorption, and with increase in mobility you get these snake-like curves. Now, these are sort of idealized patterns. Q is the departure of the differential heat of absorption from the zero value. Now, and E is the interaction energy. Now, the initial heat of adsorption, especially on metals, is very difficult to obtain because it involves a clean surface, so that you get a great deal of variation experimentally and try to get that value up there. For instance, you can clean the surface, remove the gases by vacuum and heating. But let's take tungsten. You can heat at 1200 degrees centigrade for 1 year in a vacuum, and still you will not remove all the gas. So that's the reason that the physical chemists have had a great deal of had to develop some very refined techniques in measuring these initial differential heats of adsorption. Next slide. Now, this is interesting. The energy of activation for adsorption, that's all this is. This is the energy of activation for adsorption, is least when the surface is uncovered. And then it increases with increase in coverage. Now the heat of you get the reverse effect for the energy of activation for the reverse reaction, and the difference between the two represents the heat of reaction, heat of chemisorption. That's the heat of chemisorption, Q. It's always the difference. But the sum of these two is always equal to the heat of adsorption is the difference between the activated energies of adsorption of the of adsorption and desorption. The next slide. Now this Trapnell, I think it was, made a very intensive and extensive study on the activity in adsorption of various metals with various gases. And he used about 6 different gases and 20 different metals. And this thing is, this tabulation shows you the declining activity in chemisorption. And you'll notice that all gases are adsorbed, or oxygen is adsorbed by all the gases except gold, all the metals except gold. And that this range here represents the transition elements, which have been known for 100 years to be the most active catalyst. This group here adsorbs all these 6 gases except nitrogen. Then you have the diminishing activity in chemisorption. Chemisorption is essential for catalytic activity, and therefore this is significant. Well, now what I have said about adsorption sounds like this ought to be a pretty easy way to undertake the problem of catalyst selection. But the trouble is that we're dealing here, in all of this work here, with total adsorption. And kinetics activity depends upon spectral adsorption, only specific active sites Only specific sites are active. And so it's very difficult to measure chemiabsorption gravimetrically. A metal, for instance, only the amount of gas adsorbed by a metal surface is 10 to the minus 8 gram moles per square centimeter. 10 to the minus 8. Well, you see, that's way below the range of chemical detection. And furthermore, we're not interested in total adsorption. We're interested in spectral adsorption. So the gravimetric methods are just most undependable. All we can do at present time is to compare rates. Now, the precise way, or the most precise way of measuring adsorption is by the thermoluminescence, by thermionic emission. That is, you shine light upon a catalyst surface, and you get a certain emission of electrons, and you can readily measure the electrical conductivity. And then, of course, as adsorption takes place, this thermionic emission diminishes. So that's a very precise way of measuring the chemiabsorption. So that we have to introduce a different term here, which we will call kinetic adsorption. And the distinction between kinetic, or the ratio between total adsorption and kinetic adsorption, is about 100 to 1 in the only experiment I know of. And in that field, we know just about nothing. We know very little on this problem of kinetic adsorption. So the now let's go to the next topic, and that is the crystal and electronic structure. And we'll have the first slide. Now, this is quite remarkable. You recall that the periodic table has been most useful in the selection of metallic catalysts. It has usually been found that the metals of greatest activity are found in the transition, the group 4 elements. And that is due to the absence of, in the filling of the shells, the absence of electrons in the D band. And of course, the electronic structure of a metal is entirely different from a gas. In a metal, these various shells merge together in bands, and you have a certain overlapping of these bands. So you'll have the electrons in the D band combining with one another, and some that are free to combine with electrons of the adsorbed gas. And this ratio, you have a resonance taking place, so that you have a fractional distribution between these two states. So that the ratio of the electrons that are free for bonding with external electrons compared to the ratio of the electrons that bond with one another in the D band or in the overlapping S and P band is known as the D character. And at least here is, in many reactions, it has been found that the the activity, catalytic activity, measured in some arbitrary way, is related quite directly to the de-character of the method. So there is a starting point, perhaps, in a more scientific selection of catalysts. Here you get a linear line, and it's also that the heat of adsorption, the differential initial heat of adsorption, diminishes with the D-character. So that what is wanted is a high D-character and a low heat of adsorption, initial heat of adsorption. And you'll notice here that nickel shows selectivity with respect to the faces. If you can confine your activity to one face, to the 110 face, it has a higher activity than with random arrangement. That's been well known. All right, let's take the next picture. Here's another property that's been investigated, but the trouble is with all these scientific investigations, they only study one or two reactions and one or two properties. And it's in a pretty chaotic state at the present time. But here with temperature, here you have a catalyst suspended on a carrier. And as you raise the temperature, the crystal grows. That's commonly called sintering. And with it, you have a decrease in catalyst activity and a corresponding decrease in magnetic susceptibility. So there, at least for the paramagnetic metals, such as nickel and iron, cobalt, you have the catalytic activity related to magnetic susceptibility. Right. Here is the relation of this, you see, is a catalyst suspended on a carrier. Of course, one of the purposes of the carrier is to permit smaller sizes. Now, that isn't only to increase the surface area, but to increase the activity per unit mass. There you find magnetic susceptibility and catalyst activity decreasing as the size gets smaller. So you really want to keep the size of the crystal small. Well, here is the ideal way to measure chemisorption is by thermionic emission, shining a light on a surface and measuring electrical current in the electrons that are in the gaseous phase. And here you find a relationship between the current and this so-called work function, the rest of temperatures. And this work function is the energy required to remove an electron from the level of highest energy in the solid state to a vacuum. This energy of highest state is known as the Fermi level, Fermi level. Here you have this exponential effect of the current, and this work function is related to the number of sites, active sites on the catalyst, to the surface coverage and to the dipole moment. So here you have possibly an entree into this problem of scientifically measuring catalyst activity. At least this is this would apply to metals to some extent. Well, this is all still in the exploratory stage. Let's take the next one. Well, now here is the next causes of activity are the most common and most prevalent of all. As I said, the activity of a solid depends upon its departure from an ideal state. The activity is dependent upon the fact that there are defects in the structure, and there can be a great many of these defects. These defects here, the fact that when a crystal forms, in crystallization starts from many centers at the same time, and so as it grows, they intermesh. So you get irregular boundaries. And it's the irregularity of these crystal boundaries that contribute to catalyst activity. That's one thing. Another thing is that if any strain is put upon the crystal due to sudden quenching or something like that, it causes dislocations. This would be in the X, this would be in the lattice structure. Edge dislocations or crater dislocations or spiral dislocations. But we have a lot of other defects in crystals. We have in the crystal structure a vacant atom. This one might be missing. If this were nickel oxide, let's say, you might have one of the nickel atoms missing. That would add to its activity, perhaps. Or you might have the nickel moving into an interstitial position. That would be an interstitial dislocation. Then you might have impurities, where one atom would be, and these impurities can be by displacing a regular atom in the lattice structure or appear in an interstitial position. Now all these defects have a great deal of influence upon the catalytic activity. Then you have electron defects. You'll have an electron missing, as mentioned by Professor Amsager this morning, in the structure of ice, which determines the rate at which it goes from one phase to solid to the phase. Now, you can see that any attempt to define activity in terms of these defects, impurities or dislocations or degrees of tension, is quite hopeless. How are you going to reproduce these defects? Exactly. See, at present time, we don't have any measure for these things. So it looks maybe rather hopeless, but on the other hand, this work function or this magnetic susceptibility might be one way out of it. See, at the present time, we just try out different catalysts, measure the relative rates. So we don't have any absolute measurements of catalyst activity. They're all just relative. Well, now with respect to these defects that occur, and great many articles appear on that, then you have the problem of migration of these defects. That is, if the defects disappear, the catalyst activity disappears. So it's important to know something about these defects in their mobility. And that, a good criterion there is the Taman temperature. The Taman temperature is half the melting point. And below the Taman temperature, there is no mobility of these defects, and above there is. So you've got to be very careful in handling a catalyst that you keep it below the Taman temperature. Otherwise, you lose its activity by sintering or something else. Well, now let's take the next thing. Slide. Well, if we could only carry on a whole lot of reactions, a homologous series, and measure the reaction rate and relate it to organic structure, that would be a pretty good way to predict the rate at which a catalytic reaction goes. It's very, very slow work. And even after 20 years, why, this is about the only thing we had. I mean, until I make the next statement. Here we have the dealkylation of alkyl benzene compound. Now, if you recall the reaction rate equation, we have a reaction velocity constant, which is related to the energy of activation and the entropy of activation. And then we have adsorption terms, equilibrium constants, which are dependent upon an enthalpy of activation and an entropy of activation. And in this particular reaction, as far as the adsorption is concerned, they're all the same, because in the adsorption of the products, it's always benzene. And then as far as the breaking of the bond that attaches itself to the catalyst, the heat of activation is the same. But the entropy of adsorption, the entropy of adsorption of the reactant differs, and that can be related to the bond strength in this series. Well, this is very fragmentary. About 10 years ago, I surveyed the Russian literature on catalysis, and I found very, very little. But upon repeating it this last year, it's overwhelming. I think they must have 1,000 well-trained scientists studying the rates of catalyzed chemical reactions. And at the rate we've been going in the field, why, it'd take 100 years to do what they've done. It's remarkable. And they have made, the next slide, under Ballenden, they have made some quite remarkable developments. I'm pretty sure that if we had their rate data, we could do a much better job of it. They have simply taken one particular model equation for all reactions and then got a reaction velocity constant, and then from that got a fictitious value of the energy of activation. And they've related that, this is all right, they've related that to the bond energies involved in disrupting the adsorbed molecule on adsorption, or in disrupting in the transition from the reactant to the product, and the bond energy and adsorption on the catalyst. And they're able to take their successive reactions, and the results follow on a single line. And these would be the energies of activation for different reactions of dehydrogenation of hydrocarbons, and the other two is for the alcohols, and three is for the... this is dehydrogenation of alcohol. I really think that if we could get a hold of some of this data and use some of Professor Lederson's techniques in correlating this energy of activation against these group properties, that something quite significant could be done. I don't like this scheme because, in the first place, he's neglected entirely all the engineering features involved in mass and heat transfer. And he's only considered energies of activation and not the entropies of activation nor any of the thermodynamic properties involved in adsorption. I think it's a remarkable field. I think this is the real first breakthrough that I know in attempting to relate reaction rates in catalytic reactions against molecular structure. Okay, let's follow along and see where we're at. All right, now we have we've discussed these microscopic properties. And now the macroscopic properties are, well, at one time, of course, it was quite obvious that the extent of surface would determine activity. Well, that's only one thing, but at least it's important to know something about the surface area and the porosity. That is, how available is the interior surface? Well, this is the well-known Brunauer-Emmett-Teller equation for measuring surface area. You're acquainted with that. X is the relative pressure. P is the pressure, PS is the saturation pressure. And then, of course, you can get the area from this V by the cross-section of the molecule. That comes in here. That is all quite well known. So that this feature of measuring a catalyst property is very good. But of course, surface area is only a minor part of it. With respect to liquids reaction, you don't want a high surface area because the interior surface of a pellet isn't available anyway. Diffusion is too small. And it's also true with high molecular gases. You don't want high surface area because the interior surface is not available. So it's for the smaller gases that you want high surface so that these manufacture the catalysts produce pellets with different degrees of porosity and internal area. The next slide shows the pore size distribution. When you apply a certain pressure to, say, mercury and allow it to go into a pellet, the size of opening that is made available to the mercury is given by this equation. You can measure all these things here. This is surface tension here, and this is the volume of liquid that's absorbed, and this is the partial pressure. So that from the penetration of a liquid into a pellet, you can determine a whole lot about the pore size and the pore size distribution. Well, those are the external features. Okay. Let's see what we have next. Well, now this is an application of how the internal porosity of a pellet is measured, and you find with increasing pressure, you get a smaller pore volume than you do with decreasing. You get this hysteresis effect, which you'd expect. I mean, just a little thought given to that would indicate the reason why. That is, upon releasing the pressure, you don't remove as much as you would otherwise. Now let's take the next slide. Well, maybe we better stop here a few minutes because we've discussed up to this point we've discussed the scientific aspects, and from the standpoint of engineers. We don't know a great deal about it, however, some very splendid techniques have been developed by the scientists and whatever contribution has been made in these features have all been been presented by physicists and physical chemists. I'm stopping at this time briefly to give an opportunity for any to leave that have engagements or wish to leave. And then we will proceed with the engineering aspects of it. Chemical engineer has to deal with the manufacture of catalysts, and he must have a lot of information besides what's given here. He's got to have some precise information in reactor design and operation, in the transfer of heat, mass, and momentum, and in the decline and regeneration of catalysts. He's got a big job. Now, if he can only maintain catalyst activity and reproduce it and knows his reaction rates, then he can proceed with these other things. But if he can't reproduce catalyst activity, or doesn't know the model of the reaction rate, all subsequent calculations are quite meaningless. So he usually gets his results just by operating the pilot plant. Now, solid catalysts are made in all sorts of sizes and shapes, in cylinders, in pellets, in extrusions. They're made in wires for metals and in screens and hollow spheres and in powders. And they're usually supported on carriers and rarely are single compounds used as catalysts. We add other dual or triple catalysts, and then we add promoters. Let's enumerate some of the purposes of a catalyst carrier.
Well, first of all, it's to increase the surface area per unit mass of catalyst. In other words, the means of distributing the surface, and also in maintaining smaller crystal size. Didn't you know that was very important? The smaller the crystal size, the greater the activity. Not only because of increased area, but because of decreased size. I mean, decreasing the size has two effects. It increases the activity per unit mass or per unit surface, and increases the activity per unit mass. Then it represents an economy in in use, that's about the only way you'd use platinum, is suspended over a large surface so that it can be economically distributed. And then for purposes of mechanical strength, you have a carrier to support the load and to resist attrition, that is, the wearing down as the fluid passes over it, is to retard sintering, holds the particles apart so they don't, if sintering results, you get the temperature above the Tommen temperature and migration takes place, mobility takes place, activity is decreased. It adds thermal stability. These things are quite natural if you think them out for yourself, but you usually they don't have time. And then it lowers the surface temperature by having it distributed. Decreases the temperature drop from the surface of the ambient stream. And that means you have better control. You don't have hot spots that favor the reverse reaction or decrease the selectivity of the reaction. And it alters the valence. The catalyst, if it's an oxide, assumes some non-stoichiometric relationship. For instance, the highest activity of manganese oxide is not a 1-to-1 ratio, but a 1-to-9/10, something like that. This would be the carrier, and say this is chromium oxide, and this is the gas outside. This catalyst will attempt to attain some stoichiometric ratio between these two. It's not an equilibrium. It's a steady state condition where it takes a different valence than you'd normally expect. So that's another reason for the carrier. It changes the valence. Hence, it alters the activity. So it has a lot of these very important uses. Now, for a catalyst is desired for liquid reactions or gases of molecular weight. And the high area is usually for gaseous reactions. The interior surface isn't very much available as far as liquid reactions are concerned. So, liquid. This would be below 1 square millimeter per gram. But here, with silica gel and activated carbon, you can get up to 800 square millimeters per gram. Activated carbon goes even up to here. And these are remarkable catalysts in themselves. Even without activating absorption, you can get physical absorption with silica gel. Then we have promoters. Dual catalysts. that is beside the carrier, if the second catalyst is present in a small amount, we call it the promoter. And you can see what that means. That is, you can carry on two consecutive reactions in one vessel without intermediate processing. In other words, by using a dual catalyst, you can cut your equipment in two, so that in a cyclization, aromatic or a cyclization, you go from a paraffin to an apthene to an aromatic in one reaction without the necessity of doubling your equipment and having doubling the heat exchanger equipment and doubling the condensing equipment and doubling the recovery system. And you've got to, in petroleum technology for instance, you've got to cut these costs down to a hundredth of a cent a gallon would be tremendous.
Important. Well, then we have all the problems of manufacture, and I can't go into it, but you see, in order to do this, first of all, you've got to carefully select the materials, and then you've got to have the proper binder, and then you've got to have the proper method of pelleting, and you've got to have the methods of impregnation and drying and calcination and activation. A tremendous field in the manufacture that requires all sorts of chemical engineering principles of drying and filtration and whatnot. We can't go into it, but you can imagine for yourself those problems. Well, now let's do as we did before. Just go through these figures and see what they'll show. Well, these are the simple equations for getting the external surface of a catalyst in terms of its porosity, pore structure, and you can either do that by measuring the diameter or counting the number of particles. One nice thing about dealing with catalysts is that size should be quite uniform. You can't be dealing with distribution of sizes, because that results in very poor control in all relationships. So we usually or always deal with closely sized particles. The next slide. Now we come to the problems of heat and mass transfer. And this is the latest correlation on mass transfer. You see, and it's due, we're usually dealing with low Reynolds numbers. And it's only recently that we've got data from Japanese investigators on the effect of JD, the mass transfer number, at low Reynolds numbers. So this is the relationship for mass transfer, and for heat transfer, it's just a factor of times that. This is you'll find that at this number of 80, you'll have a slight break in the curve. These are the most recent equations now for getting the gradients of pressure, partial pressures, from the catalyst surface to the ambient stream as a function of properties that you're well known of. Here is the general equation for mass transfer. This would be the surface factor. This is the area per unit mass, and this is the surface shape factor, which varies from about 8/10 to 1. But these are the relationships in dimensionless terms for getting the gradients. And you can have, for instance, on temperature, you can have as much as 1,000 degrees drop from the catalyst surface to the ambient stream. It's just a few millimeters away. Well, these are the latest equations. Then here is the Stewart's equation for getting the average diffusion coefficient in a gaseous mixture. It depends upon composition, it depends upon whether you have counter or co-current diffusion taking place. And this would be the average diffusion coefficient of component A in a mixture as related to the diffusion coefficients for the separate binaries. And this is the rate of transfer of component J with component A, which may be forward or reverse. The next slide will show the heat transfer coefficients. The latest development. And the next slide we'll show here is a runaround chart, a generalized plot for rapidly evaluating the pressure drop from a gas, partial pressure drop from a gas to a solid in terms of the various parameters. These are the Schmidt numbers in the gaseous phase, here's in the liquid phase. And over this is the Reynolds number, and these numbers here are the reaction rate numbers. The pressure drop runs through 7 cycles here. You can see the enormous effect that this heat of this rate of reaction has. This is the rate of reaction. Most of these have not been published. I'm just presenting them to you. This is the same type of plot for readily getting the temperature drop from a catalyst surface to an ambient stream. You see, if you have a big temperature drop or any pressure gradient drop from a catalyst to a gas stream, then any correlation of rate data is hopeless. It should be correlated in terms of the surface properties and not in the terms of the gas stream. So experimentally, it's desirable to operate under such conditions that you can neglect this business. So these charts are useful experimentally in telling you the conditions under which you should operate your experiments, so as you get data that you can use or correlate. If you don't have it, you might as well not correlate. The next slide. Well, then we have the problems of the pressure drops, changes in momentum. We've considered the transfer of heat, the mass, now we have the transfer of momentum. This particular work has been given in terms of the usual Fanning equation for flow through empty pipes and then providing factors for the effect of the presence of pellets. Well, we won't go into it. We'll just show the picture.
See, this would be the sphericity and the effect of packing. That's enormous. You should either have a dense packing or a loose packing, and anything intermediate is, you get channeling. If you get channeling, it's no good in any reactor. The next one is, these are some of the empirical relationships that you have to use in getting, in applying the Fanning equation and the Reynolds number to flow through packed beds. You're familiar with that. Let's pass on. This is another. Okay. And the next one. We'll drop that problem. Well, this shows how the fractional voids, it gives you a nice table for the fractional voids, the different catalysts, different shapes, and how it's affected by tube diameter and so on. Okay. This is a problem of considerable importance. I'd like to just write this frame down. If you have a steady flow reaction in piston flow or in plug flow, then it's much more desirable to use the volume of the reactor as the parameter instead of residence time. And any introduction of residence time at this point under these conditions simply adds to enormous mathematical complexity without contributing anything to an understanding of the process or to reactor design under these conditions. Because the residence time for plug flow or piston flow depends upon the temperature gradients and the partial pressure gradients and the void fractions and the number of moles of products and reactants. It's a very complex thing. Whereas the parameter V is just the, or L is just the length of the pipe. And ordinarily we're not interested in residence time, except where you're pumping liquid gasoline through a pipeline and following it with some other kind of liquid. However, when you don't have piston flow or you don't have plug flow and you don't have steady state conditions, then it's important to bring in matter of residence time and distribution of residence time. And so that, you see, and I'm dealing here with reactions catalyzed by surfaces, by a solid, where you do approach plug flow or piston flow. And I'm not saying anything about homogeneous reactions where you have a lot of turbulence and back mixing and all that. There is, of course, where the residence time is very essential and the distribution is very essential. But I just want to indicate that this particular equation, which was originally developed by K.M. Watson, gives you the very simplest approach to problems of reactor design involving heterogeneous systems, solids and gases and so forth. Well, those are some pretty strong statements, and yet we have very good justification for it, and I don't see any point of unnecessarily making the treatment of this complex by introducing a matter of residence time where you have plug flow or piston flow. You get extremely elaborate equations, but they don't add up to anything more. Well, let's take the next picture. This is an equation that I would propose, a practical one, as far as solid gases are concerned, where you do have a distribution of residence time, and sometimes you do. Then I would say, experimentally, you try to operate it so that you don't have any distribution of residence time to can. I mean, well, your holdup is zero. So instead of residence time, I put in the term holdup. E is the base of the natural logarithm. And you see, this is what you can do. VR over F, you can get from the reaction rate equation for plug flow. And VR over FC, you can get for complete mixing. And then for an intermediate case, this is a design, not scientific investigation, why you take a fraction of intermediate position by multiplying E over H times this difference. All right, the next slide. Then we come to the matter of effectiveness factor. This is a measure of the activity of the entire pellet compared to what it would be if the catalysts were all on the exterior surface. This equation was developed many years ago, and is theoretically developed for homogeneous reactions, first order reactions, and the modulus is given this way by Thiele and Watson, this one, so on. There's a lot of work needed here, but again, there's a it's pretty difficult to correlate because the structure of a catalyst pellet is not uniform. It's dense on the outside, usually. All right, let's take the next one. Now, here is the up-to-date information on the effective thermal conductivity which you need in design. Now, I'll not go into this, but these Japanese, Yagi and Kuni, have been working on this for years. See, in a catalyst bed, thermal conductivity is divided into the static effects and the dynamic effects. Static effects include the thermal conductivity of the solid and the radiation between the void spaces and the radiation between the solids and the conduction across points of contact. Then you have dynamic effects of convection and film conduction. And these have been elaborated in this way by these Japanese investigators. And then they finally boil it down to this equation for radial flow and this equation for axial flow for a given system. And then in addition, there's a wall effect. But what I've been trying to do in this lecture is to just simply give the high points in the development of the present state of the science and engineering. Next slide. Here is one of our most important cracking catalysts is silica alumina. And this shows how the surface area and pore volume is affected by T temperature and steam. In the absence of steam, it's always this line here. In the presence of steam, why, you get this. And a catalyst cracker, the area is the important thing. I see, this is not a metal, it's an oxide. All right, the next slide. I stated a while ago that as far as metals are concerned, the transition elements having a high D character have the highest activity. And similarly, the poisons, the compounds that have the greatest poisoning action, come from the group 4, group 5 elements. This is a poisoning of platinum by the sulfide ion. See, the activity drops a whole lot. Disappears. And it only takes 10 to the minus 8 molecules per square centimeter to kill it. But if you add a little oxygen, you oxidize the sulfite to sulfate, and your activity stays up. There's a tremendous amount of very valuable work done by Maxted in this field. Okay, let's just go along here. Next slide. As I said, this shows the poisoning effect. On catalyst, let's have the lights a minute here. I can write over here. On the causes of activity decline, we're just about through here. Decline of activity. First of all, you have deactivation. And then you have poisoning. And then you have power. It's very important to distinguish between these three. This is not reversible. You're removing the defects, or you're reducing the area, or you're removing the non-stoichiometry, that is your. You're removing the strain. And these are not reversible. You perhaps raise the temperature above the common temperature. And you've got to start over again. This is due to covering the site, so it's an adsorption phenomenon. And that's reversible. And this is just the accumulation, say, of carbonaceous matter or dust or something like that. There you go. If it's carbonaceous matter, you can remove it by steam or hydrogen or something like that. Remember to treat these three cases separately.
Let's have the lights real. Thank you.
Well, this is the. You remember, you can poison with such small traces. This shows the decline of activity with the sulfur compound. Very small traces, one part in a million. Bring it right down. And of course, the longer the molecules, or the larger, the more sites they cover, and hence the more effective they are in reducing activity. So you have a coverage effect and a steric effect. Those things follow pretty logically. Let's take the next one. Here is the nitrogen compounds, which poison the cracking catalyst. There you again, you have the same effect. Increase effective molecular size and shape. As you go way down to quinoline, very small activity disappears almost at once. Okay. Next slide. That's okay. All right. I guess maybe we'll quit right here.
I'll not go into this matter of regeneration. I just sort of wanted to bring you up to date on what's been done, and I think that you realize that there's a tremendous amount of work to be done. But also I think that you realize that as that engineers, you can really handle these problems pretty well. If you want to control this matter of activity, because of the other problems dealing with heat transfer, mass transfer, momentum transfer are under your control. And I also want to point out that usually the investigation that has been done by scientists working on little phases of this, or engineers working on little phases, and it requires a lot of cooperation. You've got to cooperate with the engineers and the scientists. And of course, all those facilities and opportunities are available here, right, of course, right here on your own institute. Well, it's been a great pleasure to have been with you, and it's especially to renew my associations with the faculty here, with Lederson and Terryson. And it's been my pleasure also to have met a number of former students, so I thank you.
Questions you'd like to ask, it's okay. I
perhaps won't be able to answer it, but then we can try. But we've covered such a vast field that the only purpose of this was to give you sort of a lasting impression of the significance of it and the importance of it. And one of the greatest areas for research in industrial processes today. I know the position that most of you are in at the present time. You've been listening very attentively and closely to an English lecture, and then we've covered such a vast field going from one subject to another that hasn't given you an opportunity to concentrate much. I'll try to get this thing published, and one of your, what is the name of your Norwegian technical? Yeah, I think that'll be the one. Then it'll be available. I think it'll.
Well, if there are no questions, I would like to ask Tore to thank you very much indeed for this lecture. It has been very great pleasure for us to listen to it, and I think it has taught us quite a lot. We like to look at this as a kind of continuation of the work you have done here already, especially of course in 1951 when you stayed here. And we also think that what you have presented here should also help us to improve our teaching in the subject of reaction engineering, tri-reaction kinetics. There are certainly very many things we would like to include when we get so far. It's been a very valuable survey, and we thank you very much indeed.
All right. All right.